Hello, world.
You're listening to Riding the Dragon. This is Catherine October Matthews, and today I'm speaking with Lisa Johnston. Lisa is an epidemiologist and international technical expert in the field of HIV research. She works with vulnerable and hidden populations to form a better grasp of HIV prevalence and advises on programs to help prevent its spread. I find her a fascinating person as well as an inspiration, and I hope you do too. Now here's our interview. You are an epidemiologist and you're studying HIV. And I mean, I think the pop culture representation of an epidemiologist is a scientist in a white lab coat running around maybe with a face mask or something. But on the contrary, when I met you the first time, you were talking about, you know, meeting with the prostitutes and people who inject drugs and things like this in a really personal way. What is your job like for you in the first person?
Interesting. Well, I'm definitely not your typical, stereotypical, let's say, epidemiologist, which does contact investigation, yeah, and gets a lot of press with Ebola and all. But I'm a methodological epidemiologist, and so I go out and do surveys to help understand HIV prevalence and sexual risks of these populations. And it's a really important job, and I get to come into contact with absolutely amazing people. I work mostly with people who inject drugs, sex workers, and men who have sex with men, and also now migrants, mobile populations. And there's differences in all of them. I particularly like working with transgender people and men who have sex with men. And I have a more difficult time working with people who inject drugs.
Why is that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I have so much empathy for someone who is addicted to something. I mean, I can't even imagine that level of obsession that goes into that. I just heard a story from the woman I'm working with in Palestine that one of the people that injects drugs that came into the survey was talking about how he's getting married, and the woman he's marrying is going to serve as a sex worker for him to get money for his drugs. I mean, incredibly creative thinking, but diabolical as well. You know, really selfish, really obsessive. And it's a horrible disease, and when we don't have treatment for these people, which is part of what I'm working on, we have this situation, and my heart goes out to these people, but I also find them very difficult to understand.
I think that anyone who has been alive during a certain period, like in the late 80s, kind of grew up with this idea of HIV/AIDS as a really deadly threat that really imbued people's sex lives with paranoia. Mm-hmm. The paranoia has kind of calmed down, and now it's kind of this thing that we've learned, okay, you don't have to die from it and so on. But it's not that we hear news articles anymore that are coming out that say this and this about AIDS. Where is it now as an epidemic? What is its current snapshot?
Well, it was a really popular epidemic for a while because people were so terrified of it. I mean, we're on the cusp of a cure, or potential cures are coming out, but those aren't fully investigated or proven, rather. Now that we have the antiretrovirals, and especially in countries where it's available to everybody, like the United States, people are less concerned about catching it because they know they can live out their lives. However, if you do start getting sick from it, you get horrible side effects from these drugs. So, yeah, it's less of a immediate threat to a lot of people, plus funding is decreasing. It kills fewer people than TB or malaria. So there's a lot of complaints about, hey, you know, why are you putting so much money in HIV when TB, which is curable, is killing so many more people and causing so much more morbidity and mortality? I've seen that too. But we still have certain programs in there that are important to focus on. And the targets keep changing. Like, what do we need to measure? What do we need to do? What do we need to focus on? And so it's kind of been going out of prevention and into treatment. So that keeps changing too. Prevention's more interesting than treatment anyway. But people are still dying in high numbers, especially in countries where there isn't access to antiretrovirals and testing. HIV counseling and testing isn't available, so a good number of people are dying from it.
Is it at all a factor that people may see HIV as a result fundamentally of vice? I mean, given that it's,
sure,
you know, the greatest at-risk groups come from sex and intravenous drug use.
Yeah, I get that. I've gotten into many countries, including the United States. I remember going into Houston and the passport control says, well, what are you doing here? I said, I'm here doing research on HIV and AIDS. And he said, isn't that a disease spread by gay people? I said, no, it's mostly a disease spread by heterosexual men who are unwilling to use condoms. And as a result of our stigma towards men who really want to be with a man but have to be with a woman because there's people like you judging them. Anyway, I do have my standard responses. I do enjoy those questions, yeah. Those stupid questions. Yeah, but that's built so much on stigma and discrimination. In fact, my work is dealing a lot now. It's shifting in stigma and discrimination. Mm-hmm. How do we measure it and how do we respond to it? Mm-hmm. Because that is the biggest thing driving this epidemic, is stigma. One of the biggest things, not the biggest. Stigma, our stigma and discrimination towards these people. And they're not spreading it. It is hetero. I mean, it's every sex worker, I can say just about every sex worker, wants to use a condom. Come on. It's the clients. And if you're in a desperate situation, you're willing to take more money to not use a condom. And it's the clients that do this. So these are vulnerable populations. You know, if we don't have the programs, which is kind of the work kind of part of my work as well, is trying to figure out which programs we need. If we don't have harm reduction, which means saying we know these people are going to practice these behaviors, and until we have the perfect system where we can mitigate these behaviors, eliminate these behaviors, we can at least work on them through harm reduction. Clean needles and syringes, free HIV counseling and testing, free condoms, you know, and the education campaigns, all this stuff. But things about, okay, this exists, so. And also programs where, like, if I'm a sex worker and I go to a doctor to get a regular STI, a sexually transmitted infection exam or something, and the doctor asks me how many people I've had sex with in the last week, and I tell him 97, and he looks at me like I'm some piece of crap on the floor, I wouldn't go to a doctor ever again. So these people don't have access to health care or adequate health care. Non-judgmental.
Tell us more about basically how you do your work in terms of what is your interaction with them, because you even developed a specific survey methodology to get more accurate information on these populations, right?
Yeah, well, the methodology was developed, I've just carried it forward, and I was lucky enough to be around when we were really starting to do what's called integrated biological behavioral surveillance surveys, which is what I do, my main thing. And so I go to countries on behalf of UNAIDS, Global Fund, WHO, different organizations, and I'm the technical expert to help these countries obtain data that they need to report to WHO, Global Fund, UNAIDS, in order to plan programs and to prove that there's a problem and to monitor HIV prevalence and other sexually transmitted infection prevalence and sexual risk behaviors. So I usually just go to the country and work with my counterparts, who are usually government officials or NGOs, non-governmental organizations, working with, if they have them, working on behalf of these populations. And to actually implement the survey, we try to use people who are part of the population, because there is a whole screening part. You know, how do you really know a sex worker is a sex worker? I mean, sometimes you know by looking at them, but a lot of times sex workers look like you or me. So sometimes you don't know. Or men who have sex with men, how do you know A lot of people have stereotypes about gay person having an affect and acting in a certain way, but a lot of them do not.
Yeah, and I even want to mention, like, because you specifically refer to them as men who have sex with men, not gay people, and that's for a reason, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the whole LGBTQ population it's very fluid, and there's a lot of identities. So what was happening is we were doing these surveys in the United States way back before my time, but not way back before my time, but they were doing surveys in the United States, and we realized that using terms like gay or homosexual or something was missing this whole group of men who didn't see themselves as gay or homosexual. They were married, had children. No one knew that they were having sex with men, and we needed to capture them because they are the highest risk, because they're hiding it so much, and they often meet their partners at cruising sites and more high-risk sites.
Mm. And you mentioned even specifically in your work that you're trying to find secret or hard-to-find populations. Yeah. How do you do that? How do you actually find these hard to reach?
It's a good question. So I'll get a little epidemiological on you. So there's a way of sampling a population so that the data you get from them are representative of that whole population, okay? And this is very important. What happens is the only way you can really get representative data is to do something called simple random sampling. But you need a sampling frame. You need a list of all the names. Like, we could do this, a neighborhood sample here, and we'd have a list of every household here. And we'd just randomly select, do a random selection of the households. And then in the end, although the population is 15,000, we sampled 150. We're able to say something about the whole 15,000. Okay, this is because of the way you sample. And these populations we don't have lists of. So we have to do something creative. And so there's the methodology I use is a network-based methodology. It's people, because people have connections with each other in these populations and they know each other, we rely on them to recruit each other. But there's some methodological components to it that need to be included into that. So for instance, a simple snowball sample is, you know, I select you, like we're doing a survey of lesbians or something, let's say we're two lesbians. I select you, and then you would select somebody, and somebody else would select someone. That's kind of like a snowball sample. And this method takes into account a snowball sample, but gets rid of all these biases in a snowball sample. So that in the end, we have, even though we don't have a sampling frame of these people, we're able to get something that is representative of the population we sampled, or within representative of the network of the population we sampled. Yeah, that's technical, sorry.
But this is not your first career, so I'm curious, how did you arrive at an interest in this specifically?
Oh God, it took a long time. I had no idea epidemiology existed, or public health. Every time I see someone, like a student, thinking about something to do, and they're interested, oh, I want to travel, I want to do international stuff, they kind of want to do something good. They're a little bit idealistic, like me. I say, oh, public health, because there's great jobs in public health, really interesting. But I got a master's degree in international relations, and I got out of that, and couldn't find a job. Literally, I had a master's degree, and I had to babysit. That's the only job I could find. I was so depressed. And one of the reasons is I did international relations because I wanted to do something that was international. I didn't speak a foreign language. So then I joined the Peace Corps. And in the Peace Corps, I did public health. And that's where I learned, oh, there's this field called public health. And then when I came back from the Peace Corps, I went and got a master's in public health. And then when I was getting the master's, I realized there's a really cool part of public health called epidemiology, But I didn't really start doing a lot of that until I did my PhD. Yeah, so it was took a while to get there.
When you think of your work now, which is really embedded in both science and sex workers, is this exactly what you thought it would be?
I'm probably one of the luckiest people in the world to have a job that is absolutely fulfilling. Exhausting. It's super exhausting. It's very demanding. But it's extremely rewarding. Oh my God, I get to travel all over the world, meet amazing people, and actually do something that's making a difference, which is great. I never, ever thought I'd be doing this. Not in my wildest dreams did I ever think I'd have a job like this. Can you imagine it?
What is the most challenging part of your work?
Saying no to clients, saying no to certain jobs that I want to do. I just don't have the capacity. I mean, I think last year I'm coming close to killing myself with all the travel I did. I mean, literally almost 50% travel.
Because you are a freelancer, you're an independent researcher, and you're brought in primarily by government organizations, yeah?
Yeah, and I'm really, really lucky because I have an expertise, and it took a while to have a real niche. And so I've never had to really look for jobs. They've been coming to me for the last 15 years I've been doing this, maybe. Yeah, as we talked about, yeah. If you say no to one job, it may eliminate other jobs that you would have gotten out of that job. But now I'm at the point where I don't take jobs. Like Sudan, there's a job in Sudan that just came up, and it's like, oh, I don't think I have it in me to go to Sudan. So I said no to that. Yeah. And then the job Indonesia comes up. It's like, yes, I do have it in me to go to Indonesia. That's the hard thing. It's sad. Every couple of months I break down and cry about people I meet or how people have to live, you know, with the disease plus stigma plus living in a country that doesn't treat them very well or provide for them. But what I do also appreciate is that I'm exposed to how most of the world lives. And they don't live like I do. Not that I live the best way. I don't want to judge people's outsides with my insides in the sense that because they live in a much smaller place and our house, and it wouldn't be where I would want to live, and they don't have a lot of basic needs met, doesn't mean they aren't happy or enjoying life. But I am exposed to that a lot, and I do appreciate it.
And given that you've met so many different kinds of people from so many different parts of the world, I mean, what have you learned about people or their condition?
Oh my God, we are so resilient. Human beings are so resilient and so adaptive. We can adapt so well to situations. People are really resilient. And I've learned that there's so many of us that we go over and we judge how other people live, like, oh, isn't that awful? Or, oh, that's terrible. I've had dinner with those people. I've been with those people. I've been to their homes. And they're quite emotionally fit and happy and have things that bring pleasure to them and have struggles, but somehow are able to overcome a lot of the struggles. Now, when you're sick and you don't have access to medical treatment, and you don't have enough food to eat, that's a whole nother level.
Is there any unifying feature that you have found among happy people?
Yeah, connections, family. I mean, Western culture, we're kind of removed from our families, maybe because we have so many other things to fulfill us and occupy us. But when you have like the day-to-day, like a job you go to that you probably don't like so much, and, you know, you eat rice and whatever every single day, and you don't have a lot of things that are pulling you in different directions, family seems to be really, really, really important. I'm not saying it's not important to Western culture, but I don't know if my theory that we have different distractions is accurate. And maybe I'm defending that I don't have a big extended family yet. I'm very happy. But I do see these people that I encounter a lot of the times. It seems like the unifying thing is family mm-hmm. and connections.
Are there regional differences that you find as you go to these different places with regards to how it spreads or how it...
Yeah. And we have terms for it in... epidemiology. WHO has terms like generalized epidemic means that more than 5% of the general population has HIV. I work with the level where 5% of key populations, which are these populations I work with, 5% of key populations have HIV and 1% or less of the general population has HIV. Mm-hmm. A concentrated epidemic. That's the group I work in. And so there are different ways that it's spread. In Africa, in many countries, they have a generalized epidemic where a large proportion of the adult population is living with HIV. And in some of the middle income countries where I work, it's definitely concentrated. Lower income countries, some of them in Asia, are concentrated. I guess a lot of them are. And it varies by which group. Like in Africa, it's generally spread heterosexually, so it's increasing among sex workers. Africa really, I'm not saying all of Africa, but parts of Africa, mostly East Africa, really pushed back for years against us doing surveys of men who have sex with men because they don't exist. Yeah, they don't exist. So finally we had to convince them, yes they do, we know they're about 2-5% of the adult male population are having sex with men, and that's pretty much a known fact. It really depends. Now, Eastern Europe, it's all a lot of it spread by people who share use needles and syringes and paraphernalia for injecting. So, you know, you have different approaches for that. That's Eastern Europe. It's changing quite a bit in different areas. It's a mix, you know, in Vietnam, you go to Vietnam, it's a mix of people who inject drugs, sex workers, and men who have sex with men. You know, all three groups are pretty equally spreading the disease, so, or transmitting it. Yeah, so yes, it does definitely differ by regions, by countries.
And, I mean, just for a little better of a background understanding of how all these different pieces of research fit together, you're in a branch called surveillance. How does that fit in to the bigger picture? Who do you get information from and who do you give your results to?
Okay, basically the country gets funding from Global Fund or some other entity. And in order to keep getting funding, they need to report on their progress. And so this integrated biological behavioral surveillance that I do are studies that we conduct and we repeat every 3 years to monitor change over time. And one of the things is you need to, it's expected that you have a rigorous sampling methodology, which mine is respondent-driven sampling, and that you repeat these surveys using the same protocol and the same sampling methodology. And from that we can see trends, like are we increasing HIV, are we decreasing, are we increasing our program coverage, are we increasing our HIV counseling and testing, you know, what is happening. Plus we try to do estimations of the size of the population, which is really hard to do because there's no sampling frame. So the countries get funded. They need to produce these data to report to WHO, UNAIDS, and Global Fund, whomever. And they normally own the data, the country themselves. They will own the data. And then it's a matter of analyzing it and getting it back to these organizations to keep the funding going or to change programmatic direction. Like, what do we need to do with this information? So they also use it internally to get funding to develop programs. Like, we need to have programs that are sensitive to sex workers, or we need to have needle exchange programs for people who inject drugs, things like that.
Are there still shortcomings for this way of trying to get information in? Or are there still things that you want to be able to know that you can't quite?
Oh, God, learn? There's so many shortcomings. Oh, we're doing like, it's really, really difficult to sample a hidden population. So there's a lot of biases. So I work with a team, and we do this on our own time to help improve the way we analyze the data, to help improve the methodology. We built a whole analysis program that's user-friendly, that's open source, so it's free to people. And so they don't have, I mean, my whole thing is I'm trying to work myself out of a job. I'll never do it. I'll never be able to do it, unfortunately, but I want to, we have something, build capacity, we call it. I like to build capacity to the point where they don't need an outside international consultant, you know, mm-hmm. to come in and do it. But that's a major flaw because they change jobs, new people get hired, people in some cultures aren't really rigorous. Like some cultures don't pay attention to detail like you need to mm-hmm. do this type of methodology. They don't know the analysis. You know, there's things like, so there's all these gaps that make it impossible for me to work myself out of a job. But some countries have improved. They've been able, they've taken it on themselves with mm-hmm. help. I wrote a manual, like a really user-friendly 300-page manual, step-by-step of how to do the methodology. Mm-hmm. So I think that's helping a lot of people. That gets a lot of reads.
I wanted to also ask you too, I mean, since you are studying an epidemic, if it were cured, would you fundamentally be out of a job? And would it be your goal? Would mm-hmm. that be your goal, to be out of a job?
Even when there are cures, like TB has a cure, people still get it. But then they have to be under, I mean, if you look at antiretrovirals as a cure, which it isn't, because you have to take it your whole life. I mean, but if there is a cure, let's think about TB, because TB has a cure. You have to take a lot of medication for a long time. And I used to work in TB quite a bit. And so what happens with that is that the people that get active TB are usually really poor, vulnerable populations like migrants or people who use drugs in close proximity to each other, people who live in horrible housing conditions, homeless people. So people have really kind of low immunity. And these are people that have a really hard time sticking to a 6 to 9 month regimen of medication. And so they never get cured. So, you know, saying that there's a cure doesn't mean that it's going to be practicable, that people are going to be able to do it and that we're going to be able to reach everybody. So people who are in a situation to be very responsible aren't usually those people that have active TB they might have HIV. There's a lot of people that have HIV that are not vulnerable populations, and they might do well on some kind of cure regimen if it were similar to TB regimen.
What do you wish that people knew in general about HIV and the way it's spread and carried?
It's not easy to get HIV, but it's easier for other people, some people, to get HIV. I'm not a religious person, but I sure do like this quote of, "But for the grace of God go I." And that's something that I've really learned in this work. And if people could practice that more, and thinking about people living with HIV, you know, it's like, oh, you have HIV? Well, you slut, or what did you do to get that? You know, and you do have to do something to get it. But just the lack of compassion by so many people and the ignorance. So I wish people would just try to understand that some people aren't as lucky. I mean, it's usually the people coming from a place of religion, you know, looking down on others because others don't follow their religion, or people who live comfortable lives and have everything they need, or people who I don't know, there's people who are all kinds of people judging others, and they don't understand the story, the whole story. They're just reacting from what they know and what they think is right. Human beings are very, very complex and unpredictable. But walk a mile in someone else's shoes and then say something.